Stradiates. He had an unusual way of putting all these different terms together to express his political ideas. And he's employing these different typefaces in his work. And he's following William Harvey in the way that he's proposing a bicameral legislature, because he's following on this work that William Harvey did as an anatomist and as a physician in his exploration of the circulatory system and the way that he changed how the heart was understood, right? So he's actually following that change in physiological knowledge and applying that into the sphere of political economy, which is, you know, coming into play, coming into birth at the exact same time. And he's one of the figures that's really passing this along then to William Petty through his use of political anatomy, which we'll see that Petty and Harrington knew one another. And the American founders of the Constitution here, they followed Harrington in some weird ways that are generally well noted in the literature, but aren't well noted by Americans. And for example, Harrington, as I said, proposes bicameral legislature because he believed in a spiritual democracy and a spiritual aristocracy. And he believed that you needed the lower house to propose legislation and the higher house of the spiritual aristocracy to enact it. And like we said, he was also very buddy-buddy with the Stuarts, with Elizabeth Stuart, with the German wing. So he's also not really against monarchy either. And he places a lot of emphasis on land ownership as basically the main criterion for being a member of the spiritual aristocracy. So he's a very interesting character. You can see how he is carrying over into American constitutional theory, and that this is why we have our land-owning aristocracy here, of our plantation owners or what have you, and the way that we have our two houses, and the way that we have this executive president. It's all very much in the Harrington Republican tradition, which is why someone like Pocock identifies Harrington in the way that they do, places such emphasis on Harrington within this tradition, because he really is. He transmitted all these ideas, but you can't interpret them anachronistically. And to give you an example of what Harrington was thinking about, look at this quote from him. It's actually really interesting. I like this one. "Formation of government is the creation of a political creature after the image of a philosophical creature, or it is an infusion of the soul or faculties of a man into the body of a multitude." So you're already getting into these images that we've been talking about before of the meta and the of the macrocosm and the microcosm that have been around for a long time. And my intention isn't to say that James Harrington or William Petty is that they basically came up with these kind of body politic or anything like that. Those ideas have been around before, those metaphors have been used. But I'm trying to illustrate how really it's in their consistent kind of adaptation of these metaphors to new knowledge, and they're bridging together with some other tendencies that we're going to see, that they form a nexus together that draw in all these different threads, and that's really what gives rise to political economy. Because at the same time, we're dealing with certain ideas about atoms and about corpuscles, corpuscularism, right? And the idea of these little tiny particles that are being added up into greater combinations to form more complex matter. That's another contemporary theory that's going around. And you have to understand, now we're going to get into the importance of Francis Bacon here. Francis Bacon is a fundamental figure. And people have had trouble over the years sorting out why Francis Bacon is important and what his actual legacy is, because no one has really gone through and reconstructed all Francis Bacon's thought. For a long time, the common opinion about Francis Bacon was that he didn't really have a coherent or consistent method that he was advocating for, that he was sketching out in his works. If you read Peter Gay's Enlightenment, he kind of makes it out so that Francis Bacon's main legacy is that he's an inspiration to science, is that he uses a lot of poetic language to inspire science in its future progress. But that's not really the case when you start going back to his works. I was going into just a little bit, and what I'm really have been interested in is Francis Bacon's method of induction, because that's a big dividing point that you're going to see running through all this history, and especially down into the 19th century, surprisingly. That's one thing that I actually found out, is that in the debate that we're going to talk about a little bit later between Karl Menger and between Gustav Schmaler, is that it's an induction versus deduction debate about their methodology. But really, it all goes back to Francis Bacon and his advocacy for the inductive method. What is the inductive method? Well, Francis Bacon is advocating, just like these corpuscles are being added up to create more complex matter, and just like individual political actors and households are being added up to create an economy, Francis Bacon is turning that into a general method of science and investigation, is that he really wants to focus on data and empirical facts. And that's partially because before, in the idea of natural history, is that he was very unsatisfied with how his predecessors had conducted that. And by natural history, we're talking about, you know, the precursor for natural philosophy, the combination, the collection of all these different facts from antique sources about what the world was like, what nature was like, animals, different species of plants and animals, things like that. And they would be compiled into all these big compendiums, these giant books that would list them all. And basically, scholars that would construct these natural histories would go through all these antique sources, all these medieval sources, and they would try to locate out all the little bits of knowledge and add them all up. And it wouldn't, in Francis Bacon's mind, add up to anything at all, because a lot of this information was incorrect and it had basically been compounded over the years through this repetition, through these natural histories, which weren't actually based on any experience, first of all. But, you know, they weren't curious about, they weren't curious about exploring anything on their own, about having their own encounters with nature. And so Francis Bacon has kind of a complicated legacy in that sense, where he does take a sharp turn away from Aristotle, and he maneuvers himself, positions himself as being opposed to the ancients and opposed to Aristotle. But then at the same time, Francis Bacon is not really saying that he hates Aristotle, or that he thinks that there's no value in anything that anyone ever did before, which sometimes he is read as saying something like that. But what Francis Bacon is really just trying to get away from these kind of sterile, stuffy, overstuffed natural histories, and he's trying to reorient science into a new inductive method. And for Francis Bacon, it's not science, it's the reform of all knowledge, which is important to note. That's a big thing here that's going to be followed by all Francis Bacon's followers. And Francis Bacon's legacy, it slumbered for a while, it hibernated for some time. And it wasn't until the Restoration that basically Baconianism flourished, and it was actually through something called the Royal Society, the Royal Society of England, which is the first scientific kind of academy of several. Or is it the first? I'm not actually sure. I should look that up. It might have been the French Academy came first, but really it's the French and the British academies, the Royal Academy, that are the first scientific academies, scientific establishments that are being formed in Europe at the same time. In Leibniz, he's actually, if you don't know, a member of the Royal Academy of England as well. But he, for a long time, was endeavoring to get an academy formed in Berlin, in Prussia, which he was eventually successful with, which has its own whole history. I actually wrote a little article about kind of the modern University of Berlin from the 19th century, and that has its roots in a lot of different ways in Leibniz's academy. But we won't get too into that right now. The point is that we're talking about the kind of the era now of Newton, of Boyle, of Locke, and the debates surrounding the Royal Academy. The Royal Academy is very important as, first of all, a Baconian establishment, a Baconian society. One thing to note here is that the term society, when we say Royal Society, is that in this context in 17th century England, is that they were using society in the older sense of ancient Rome, of Latin, and that didn't have the meaning of sociological society in the sense that it comes to mean with Simmel or Weber or the sociologists of the 19th century, which, you should go read their works. You should go read Simmel and his sociological essays, because you'll see that the conception of sociology, of a sociological society, is something much different from the way that they were using it in 17th century England, where, you know, for the Royal Society, it meant a club, right? That's how they took it to mean. And that was, you know, they were following the Romans in that. They didn't, you know, have an idea. They didn't have a term society in that sense until later. But in any event, this is important because it was actually James Harrington's special club, his Rota Club, that was became a prototype for the Royal Society. And this was, the Rota Club was actually the first of all the different coffeehouse clubs that would go on to proliferate in the later 17th century and into the 18th century. And there's lots of famous ones of those. There's the Kit Kat Club of Joseph Addison, for example, which was the major Whig cultural club. And it was actually Walpole, the first prime minister of England, came out of that scene. And there was Samuel Johnson's club. And all these different clubs are very famous. The first one, though, was James Harrington's Rota Club. And this was a Republican club where Harrington tried to implement or enact experiments in Republican democracy. Or he tried to kind of model his club or have his club run in such a way that would demonstrate some of his political ideas. But it was around this time that Harrington, like I had mentioned before, was arrested and taken away. And according to his biography, I can't make sense of it, of any definite reason why this happened. There's dispute about that. The claims are very vague against Harrington. They just say Harrington, he was meeting about wanting to change the form of government under the Stuarts or something. But it doesn't seem that there's much substance to the actual arguments. Harrington did get out of prison eventually, and he went insane at that point, I guess probably from palsy. I don't really get the sense that it was much of a conspiracy or that somebody had poisoned him or anything, but it was actually, like I said, this kind of society which not only goes on to influence all these coffee house clubs and societies that are so important, but it really goes on to influence the Royal Society. And the Royal Society has a longer history that actually goes back to before the Civil War and goes back to a couple different people like Samuel Hartlieb. And that has a whole religious kind of puritanical utopian flavor to those early versions of the Royal Society. And some people trace the Royal Society actually to the Catholic colonists who are going into Ireland, which is a big issue during the Civil War, that eventually Oliver Cromwell has to go into Ireland and bust up all the Irish heads and make everything right over there for, you know, so the Papists, the Catholics over there, don't get in the way of the English settlers. But some people trace the Royal Society's real origins to kind of secret societies in Ireland of the English colonists who are coming and trying to take over Ireland from the Catholics. But that's a whole other story. I'm not going to go and dwell on that. There's a lot of history here. The more that I look into it, it amazes me. Me and Ed are talking about this. We want to keep going and delving into this and exploring it because I want to write like a whole, long essay book or something about this, because there's a lot of threads here that have been percolating, but they're not all drawn together in the literature and the scholarship. They've been kind of separated for a few different reasons, just because of academic specialization, is that you have some people who are interested in the early history of science, and some people are interested in the history of literature, and some people are interested in the history of economics. They don't always come together in the way that they should, but if you go through, you want to go on JSTOR, look up, there's tons of papers on all different types of subjects relating to this are really fascinating. But the thing about the Royal Society is that the first thing that the Royal Society publishes is by a guy named John Evelyn, and it's called Silva, right? And this is actually really interesting because it was actually John Evelyn who was able to get the Royal Charter in order for it to be called the Royal Society. It was just a private society initially, and there had been all these different prototypes for it. There was a lot of cross-pollination of these little nascent societies, these little groups, these scientific clubs, which involved all these cross-cutting members of all these different members. Some of them are people like John Evelyn, Samuel Hartlieb, and all these people that have gone to join the Royal Society, and that's how they all eventually come together. And it was through also partially the Rota Society that brought some of them together, because William Petty and William Petty's friend Samuel Pepys were members or attendees of actually Harrington's Rota Club. And you can go and look at Samuel Pepys' diaries. Samuel Pepys, if you don't know, he's most well known today for his, you know, being a diarist of the Restoration, and his diaries are taken as a really famous source, a primary source of information about what was life like in England in the late 17th century. That's usually how almost everyone primarily thinks of him. What I didn't know was that Samuel Pepys during the Restoration is that he was in the Admiralty of the Navy under James II during the Restoration, and he was actually a very influential guy who was a top naval man for 30 years who helped build up the Royal Navy as it would eventually become. This is kind of the sleeper period of the English naval history before they become the maritime empire, right? It's actually, this is the period where they start building up to that. It's between the Spanish Armada and between the 18th century and the Napoleonic Wars and so all their famous glory periods. But it's really Samuel Pepys during his 30-year reign in the Royal Navy and his time in the Admiralty where he's actually building up to the modern maritime empire. And he's Samuel Pepys' friends, very good friends, I suppose. I don't actually know. I haven't reviewed it closely enough to comment on kind of the group that's formed here. There's layers of intimacy here, right? And I get the sense that John Evelyn and Samuel Pepys and William Petty especially are kind of a close-knit group that were friends for a very long period of time. And then some of the other, you know, members of the Royal Society, they're more outliers. But it's really a fascinating kind of conjunction of social circles here, especially with these three guys. Because like I said, John Evelyn, his Silva is the first work that's published by the Royal Society, and he's actually the one who gets the charter for the Royal Society. And the way that this works is that the Royal Society basically licenses out its name in order to publish things, kind of. So, you know, this is his work, Silva, is the first thing to get published under this license by the Royal Society, kind of their first officially endorsed publication, if you will. But Silva is about forestry, right, of all things. And it's a very eclectic kind of work that is trying to go through and talk about gardening and about forestry and about all these different kinds of plants. And it's an example of Baconian science in that sense. It's very inductive. It's a replacement for these older, obsolete natural histories that Bacon was trying to get away from. And the crazy thing about this, actually, is that this is one of the very first works where the term organism comes into play. And you can go look up, there's some good papers I've actually posted these on Twitter in screenshots and whatnot, is that just tracing the concept of organism back. We have been talking about the way that the cybernetics people of Norbert Wiener and who all these other guys, how they were using this term organism, how this concept of organism, and basically constructing a false metaphor where they were overextending the metaphor and saying all society is like an organism and it has homeostasis, feedback regulation, and blah, blah, blah. But if you go back to this period, which I suppose they didn't know of, which is strange because Norbert Wiener is always invoking, of course, Leibniz in a lot of different ways, which I reviewing that, that's a whole other episode we'll get into. But reviewing that, it doesn't seem that his invocations of Leibniz are very substantive, in my opinion. But Leibniz is definitely connected into this use of organism, these early uses of organism. And it's really in this context of the Royal Society and it's people like John Evelyn and Silva where that term is appearing for the first time, and they mean it as organized system. They are not using the term organism or the concept of organism to refer to a biological organism. That's not until the 19th century that that happens, right? And this period, in this late 17th century, they're using organism generally just to mean a self-directed, self-organizing system as something with a self, is something that's purposeful, right? That has an internal purpose that's teleological. And so they're not using it in this biological sense. So really when Norbert Wiener and these cybernetic people, when they are employing these metaphors to organism, they're just, it's a tautology. They're just saying that society is like an organism. And then what's actually an organism? If you go back to the Royal Society in the 17th century, it's just it's a organized system. So they're just really saying that an organized system is an organized system. It's nonsensical. But that's really the kind of thing that you only get into when you get into this history and you start trying to reconstruct it for yourself. But to get to William Petty, so William Petty is he's what's called a projector, I guess is the correct word, which in modern terms you would probably use the word entrepreneur, maybe, which, you know, the term projector has a negative connotation. And it means, in this sense, someone who proposes projects. Projects that are drawing on the funds of the Bank of England, which is to be created in 1695, or, you know, patronage of some kind, credit of some kind, in order to have these, in order to implement these schemes of infrastructure improvement or political improvement of some kind, colonization. So you have people like Defoe, Daniel Defoe, eventually, he writes a very important, influential essay kind of satirizing the projectors, and projecting is, that's the big term you'll see all throughout this period of time in the literature and in newspapers and everything. Projecting is, has a very negative connotation. But for better or worse, William Petty was a projector. And the interesting thing here is that somebody like William Petty is that he's able to slip through several different administrations without really having these partisan problems that you would expect, because he actually, like I said, he's trained as a physician, but really he kind of makes his fortune, so to speak, well, literally makes his fortune under Oliver Cromwell in regards to the Irish problem, like we were saying with these English settlers who are going over to try to defeat the Catholics, take over Ireland from the Catholics. So William Petty is actually the person who Oliver Cromwell hires to go over and do a survey of Ireland. And it's actually at that time pretty much the most advanced geological or topographical survey that's conducted anywhere at that point. It's called the Downs Survey. It's a very big deal. It lasts for a long time. You can go look up the maps online. It's pretty interesting to look at. But William Petty is not only interested with surveying the land, but he's also interested in demographic surveying and with statistics. And it's actually very important, too, because William Petty is kind of the father of statistics, according to some sources. And it's actually during the plague year. It's kind of famous thing. If you've ever seen the movie Restoration, you know, you'll, with Robert Downey Jr., you know, there's a famous period of the plague, or, you know, I'll give you more credit if you read, not that, actually, I shouldn't say that, because Restoration is a good movie. I like it. But if you want to go look at something like Daniel Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year, you know, famously during the Restoration, there was an outbreak of plague, and William Petty was one of the statistical pioneers in his ideas about statistical causality, his idea of probability, really. And he brings probability into its kind of modern scientific statistical sense in some of the work that he's doing in epidemiology. Not that that existed at the time, but he's a big influence there as well. William Petty is a very, very serious guy here because, well, to go back to Ireland, right, is that this is kind of his projector side as he goes over to Ireland. And one of the things that they had actually done, Cromwell and the Parliament, is that they had basically promised all this land to basically anybody who would go and support them in their wars and give them money. And they would say, we'll just give you land in Ireland, right? Who cares? But then obviously push came to shove. Someone had to kind of figure all that out. And William Petty was very instrumental in doing that with the Down Survey. But then also there was a trade that opened up, right, with certificates or deeds for the land that was going around that was promised, and it was got kind of speculative, and originally it was supposed to go to all these soldiers, but all these different kind of deeds or certificates for this land got all bought up, and, you know, William Petty ultimately came out ahead. But the interesting thing is that when the Restoration happens, there's no partisan bad blood here. There's no thing where Charles II comes in and kicks Petty out and executes Petty or something for helping out Cromwell's. Petty is just a very, he's very valuable guy in terms of his ingenuity, his scientific thinking, his, all of his different skills that he has. But also, even more than that, he's not really a partisan political person, is that he's associated with the Royal Society, and they have kind of these ideals that cross-cut across partisan politics and across, you know, the traditional divides of partisan of Protestant and Catholic and royalist and Tory and Whig and all this, you know, that for too long, I guess, in the standard interpretation of this history, it's been asserted that, you know, these are the defining dichotomies that frame all this history. It's really not the case, especially at least for somebody like William Petty and for, you know, these other characters that he associated with, like Pepys, and they were more savvy than that. They didn't kind of fall into those traps. They knew how to be useful, and they knew how to survive across these different regimes and make themselves useful. And so after the Down Survey, and after William Petty made his fortune during the Restoration, he just goes back and hangs out in England, and he starts designing these experimental boats with Samuel Pepys, you know, in order to promote the British Navy and British commerce. He's trying to create these double-hulled, super-fast boats. He's associating, like I said, with Samuel Pepys, but also with other members of the Admiralty, and they're hanging out with these guys like John Evelyn and also a guy named John Wilkins. And who's Wilkins is that, Leibniz, like I said, was a member of the Royal Society. And you may be aware of Leibniz's big project to construct a universal language is kind of one of his big famous things. And John Wilkins was actually one of the precursors to that, or one of the contemporaries who was working on a very similar project. And he was a member of the Royal Society. And Leibniz reviewed his work and had a lot to say about it. It wasn't exactly what Leibniz was trying to do, but it's still very interesting that there was a confluence of these universal language projects with John Wilkins, and he's in the Royal Society with William Petty, and Leibniz is in the Royal Society. It's quite interesting because, you know, the universal language projects, they seem so quaint or seem so archaic to us today, but really what they're concerned about is the relationship between signs and meaning, and that's kind of what Leibniz and Locke end up debating about, is the difference between real essences and nominal essences. For somebody like Locke, he thinks that when you say silver, or when you talk about silver, you're referring to a list of properties which silver possesses, you know, metal like silver or gold, it's heavy, it's dense, it is, you know, lustrous, it has value, right? And for Locke, all those properties belong to the object that's being spoken about, and they're not subjective. And he's not talking about any sort of spiritual substance or subjective substance that's endowed metaphysically in the object itself or anything like that. He just thinks that literally there's piece of silver and it has value and it's dense, and, you know, that's what he means by nominal essences. But for these new metaphysicians, these rationalists in the tradition of Descartes and Leibniz and Spinoza, is that they are advocates for these real essences and for these subjective ideas of essence. And there's a big, you know, problem with signification and representation and terminology, and what do words represent. And, you know, Locke, for his part, is very strangely, I think, concerned. Something I want to know more about, I haven't been able to find enough yet, but Locke is very interested in the problems of kind of metaphorical proliferation. Of, he has this image or nightmare of language being like this Hydra monster, where basically all these different words and metaphors and terms are going to proliferate and spiral out of control, and it's going to destroy objective meaning and objective value of silver. He's a silver bug, if you didn't know. But that's a whole other debate that they're having at the same time that goes into this universal language debate. And so I hope that you can sort of start to see the way that all these different threads are connecting, like I was talking about, because it's not just one metaphor or anything like that. It's not just that William Petty, employed the idea of the body politic or anything, or the society or economy as an organism. That's not his main accomplishment, even though he did do that, especially, which I think is impressive, because for circulation of money, especially, that's his metaphor. That's, he came up with circulation of money, velocity of money, comparing it to the blood flow. And really, that's not his, you know, that's not where economics comes from all by itself. It's in the nexus, as you would say, or as I would say, of all these different threads that I'm talking about, with organism, with the idea of the self-organizing system, teleological organisms, universal language problems, representation problems, the idea of the physiological metaphors that are informing the construction of society and economy, All these different things, like I've just been listening throughout this whole kind of monologue, is they're all coming together.